Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. All through the American involvement in Iraq, the news media have reported on the numbers of soldiers killed. And every time a major benchmark was met, we had stories. When it was 100, 500, 1,000, 1,500, and not all that long ago when the number went over 3,000. So we've had stories, and when individuals die, their communities honor them, and we have stories about that. However, our guest for this hour of the show, Dr. Ronald Glasser, says that the story of this war cannot be told only by the count of the dead. He says that, in fact, the true legacy of this war may not be seen in the way that we honor the fallen, but in the way that we care for the wounded. Ronald Glasser is a pediatrician, practices medicine in Minneapolis. He also has been an Army doctor. He was a doctor in the military in Vietnam, and perhaps a lot of people will know him for a book that he wrote, 365 Days, which was a story of his tour of duty as an Army doctor during the Vietnam War. He has written a number of other books, and last summer published his seventh, titled Wounded, Vietnam to Iraq, which takes a look at how battlefield medicine has changed, how the nature of the wounds soldiers experience have changed, and about this dramatic change that we have seen when we make comparisons between war now and war at the time of Vietnam, where we have many more soldiers profoundly injured, surviving those injuries, and then coming home needing care, in some cases needing care and help for the rest of their lives. Questions, comments are certainly welcome in this hour of the show as we talk with Dr. Glasser. The number, if you're here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line that is good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So locally, 333-9455. That's the number to call if you're here in Champaign-Urbana. But if you're listening over the air somewhere around Illinois or Indiana, or even people listening on the internet, as long as you're in the United States, you may use that toll-free line, and that is 800-222-9455. So at any point here, questions, comments are certainly welcome. The only thing we ask of callers is that people are brief, and we just ask that to keep the program moving along and get in as many callers as possible. But certainly anyone is welcome to call. Dr. Glasser, hello.
Well, it's nice to be with you.
Well, we certainly appreciate it. I know this is something that concerns you greatly and that you've done a lot of writing and speaking about, certainly ever since the book came out last summer. But even, I think, before that, this was something that you felt it was important for people to pay attention to.
Well, I mean, not only important, but I think desperate. I wrote my first article about the casualties in this war in the Harper's issue in July 05. Mm-hmm. It was called the War of Disabilities. And I had maintained my friendship since Vietnam with officers who were company-grade officers in Vietnam. They were now, at the beginning of 2000, were general and field-grade officers. And I admired these officers. I admired the Army. I grew up in the Army. I can remember the first time we had mass casualties at our hospital. I think they had sent the 101st Airborne back into the Ashau Valley, and it was 68 after the Tet Offensive. And we were getting 60 and 80 wounded a day, maybe every 8 or 10 hours at Zama in Japan. And during mass casualties, all physicians have to go up to the operating rooms, and the Army, in their wisdom, exempts psychiatrists. But everybody else had to go up, and I was assigned, I was a pediatrician, and I was assigned to the orthopedics ward, or orthopedics operating room, and I didn't want to go, and our hospital commander, Colonel Payton, came through, and I stopped him, and I had the audacity and the nerve to say, you know, Colonel Payton, I'm a pediatrician, and I haven't been in an operating room since the second year of medical school. And he didn't want to hear that nonsense at all. He put his hand on my shoulder and said, "That's okay, Captain. We'll just give you the little wounds." And that's David, when I knew I was in something different. Right. And I admired the military. I thought that the people were terrific. And I still do today. I mean, where in our culture Can you take an 18, 19, 20-year-old kid and teach him that what he says matters, that he has to take care of the person next to him, and that there are some things bigger than himself? Because of that, I was really distressed after the war began when I, maintaining my friendship with people in the Army and physicians, began to realize that the number of casualties starting in, in February, maybe September of 03, were just outstripping the number of deaths. And so I called around, and it proved to be correct. You know, most of the casualties were in supply units. And if they were in supply units, it didn't take a genius to figure out that the supply lines were not being protected. And we didn't have enough troops. I mean, everybody began to know that. So I wrote an article for Harper's called The War of Disabilities, because it appeared to me and to others that the real risks in this war was not related to the number of deaths, but to the number of casualties. And in some kind of prescient way, I ended that article with this sentence. Ultimately, if the Bush administration continues its refusal to accept the realities of this conflict, the most enduring images of the Iraq war will be the sight of the legless and the addled beggars on our street corners holding cardboard signs up that read, "Iraq vet, hungry and homeless, please help." I got blasted because of that article about, you know, being unpatriotic and, you know, we were winning and these kind of things. You know, why don't you just talk about the good things? Well, now we are, 4 years later, and the book that came out and the articles from that book, like in the Washington Post on April 8th, the emails, no angry emails, people just saying thank you. And it has turned out worse than I thought. When I wrote the Harper's article, I started calling my friends who had been in the military, and I said, you know, is this Vietnam? And everyone said yes. And I said, why? And they said, we never had enough troops in Vietnam. We don't have enough troops here. We never sealed the borders in Vietnam. We're not sealing the borders here. We never had an exit strategy in Vietnam, and God knows there's no exit strategy here. We tried to train the South Vietnamese army, and they lasted 6 months. The Iraqi army will last 6 weeks. This administration has tried desperately not to equate this war with Vietnam, but it is. The big difference, of course, the enormous difference, is the number of casualties to deaths. In this war, it's 16 to 1. In Vietnam, it was 2.6 to 1. In the Second World War, 2.4 to 1. In our Civil War, 0.7 to 1, because if you were wounded at all, the wound got infected and you died from the infection. And it was these huge number of casualties, I'm convinced, unexpected number of casualties compared to fatalities, that sunk Walter Reed. You know, when you visit Walter Reed, it was clear that the inpatient care was terrific, but the number of outpatients, the inpatients, was 17 to 1. You know, I mean, they didn't have the capacity to house them, so they opened Building 18, and they were just scrambling around. And it is what is sinking the VA system. I mean, the numbers here are stunning. Mm-hmm. And this administration, and indeed I would think most of America, is either unaware or simply doesn't care.
I would certainly hope that it's not that. My question, I guess, would be, as I said, all along, the media have reported on numbers of people killed. We haven't seen as many stories about people who come back profoundly injured and some of their difficulties in getting treatment and getting help and getting back to their lives. I think that it was true, at least at one time, that even if you were a reporter and you wanted to do that story, it was difficult to get information out of the Department of Defense. Do you think it is that the military made it difficult to do that story, or do you think that it was that the news media weren't really that interested in that story?
Well, I mean, you know, I've had that question myself. I mean, what is a pediatric nephrologist sitting in Minneapolis doing writing articles that end up in the national magazines on the front cover? Part of it, I'm sure, is that we've had a press that has been mostly stenographers rather than reporters. But the other is that this administration has obfuscated the dangers and the risks in this war. It's not only, David, that they never let you photograph caskets coming home. The president never went to any funerals. The wounded that come in from Landstadt, Germany, and that land at Andrews Air Force Base, they land at night. I mean, the number of medals given out in this war, and it's been 4 years, is, astonishingly small. I mean, I think there's been one or two Congressional Medal of Honors at this time. I think there were 43 in Vietnam. I've talked to a number of reporters who have called, partly because of the article in the Washington Post, but mostly because they've read Wounded, and have called asking for advice, asking where they can go to find references about traumatic brain injuries and shock waves and so on, you know, all of which are in the book. Mm-hmm. And those who have written about this war, like Bob Little for the Baltimore newspapers, has said, you know, it's just hard to explain the details. Either our editors haven't been interested or they put it on the back page. There has been this obfuscation about this war. I mean, I talked to the Marines that made the second fight at Fallujah, and those battles were as desperate as the battles at the Tet Offensive in Vietnam. I mean, but nobody heard about it. Mm-hmm. I'm sure that you and your readers are absolutely listeners are absolutely unaware of Leanne Hester. I mean, Leanne Hester is the first woman to receive a Silver Star for close-in combat since the Second World War. She was a member of the Kentucky National Guard, I think military police, the 409th unit, got into a firefight protecting a convoy in 04, and she and the sergeant in her Humvee actually saved everybody in the convoy by entering the kill zone, by realizing that the insurgents were attacking from a trench on the side of the road, jumping into the trench and working their way down the trench, the two of them, killing insurgents as they went along. She received the Silver Star. You haven't heard of her.
No.
And most people haven't. I mean, her unit for the Kentucky National Guard, you know what their duty was before they got sent to Iraq to patrol the roads between, I think, Balad and Baghdad? Mm. Their job was crowd control at the Kentucky Derby. And there they are, in Iraq. The other is, you know, I've asked when I've given my talks, the people in the audience, how many women do they think have rotated through Afghanistan and Iraq since the war began, and these are women that we have sent over to run the most dangerous roads in the world. And, you know, people say 300, 400, 2,000. It's 250,000. I mean, the numbers are staggering. You know, how many, I mean, we can go on and on like this. How many orphans have resulted from the war because the women who have joined the National Guard or the Army, the regular units, have joined it as a way up, as much as a way out, and single parents get killed, and their kids are orphans. I mean, I had one of the just interviewing. I mean, where until the Washington Post with Dana Priest and Ann Hall wrote their articles about Walter Reed in the Washington Post, where were the reporters? I called when I was writing the book and interviewed one of the women at Walter Reed, a terrific lady who graduated from West Point 2001 and was in the 3rd Infantry Division and had her right arm blown off when an armor-piercing RPG came through her Humvee and took her arm off. And she had a total right arm disarticulation. And in interviewing her, you know, I mean, just talking, and I know a lot about all of this. I made the mistake of asking what prosthetic device she had chosen. Because Walter Reed gives you three, a servo, muscular, a cable driven, and a cosmetic. And she said that, well, she had chosen the cosmetic. And I said, you know, naively, I said, well, you know, they look good, but they don't function. And she said, well, I know. And there was this hesitation, and the hesitation I've heard before, you know, you interview somebody, you get that hesitation, and the hesitation is, you know, who is this schnook asking me these questions? And she said, you know, I weigh 115 pounds. She said the servo muscular upper extremity prosthetic and the cable weigh about 20 pounds. She said, I can't carry it. She said, that's the reason that all of us women, honestly, but all of us women choose hooks. Yeah. And, you know, I was humiliated. I was embarrassed. Of course they pick hooks. Well, how many articles have been written about women who have been wounded in this war and are Walter Reed and choose hooks?
I wanted to get us to talking to some people who are calling in, and I do have several, and also want to reintroduce you, the guest, for people who might have just tuned in the last few minutes. Before we started, at least, our guest this morning in this hour is Dr. Ronald Glasser. He is a pediatrician. He practices medicine in Minneapolis. He also is a writer. He was a doctor, served as an Army doctor during the Vietnam War, and wrote a book about that, 365 Days. It was written in 1970. A lot of people think it was one of the best books about the Vietnam experience. More recently, he published his seventh book. This came out last June. The title of that book is Wounded, Vietnam to Iraq, which takes a look at the experiences of soldiers wounded fighting in Iraq. And this is something that he obviously is very concerned about and has done a lot of talking about and a lot of writing about. So if you're interested in taking a look at the book, I'm sure that you can find it in the bookstore or in the library. And questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. We do have a number of callers, and why don't we start talking with them, and we'll begin with someone who's listening in Chicago. This is line 4. Hello.
Good morning, gentlemen. I find this discussion very interesting. As a matter of fact, isn't it true that we've already had 69 women killed in Iraq?
I think it's closer to 300.
300?
Yeah, I think so.
Wow.
These numbers are, just to track down these numbers are really difficult. I mean, let me give you an example. The VA, in the VA statistics, they say that there have been at least 55,000 wounded. The Pentagon's numbers are 22,000. Well, when I was writing the book, I said, you know, why the discrepancy? And I said to myself, well, the VA is concerned about taking care of these kids, and not so many kids now in the National Guard and Reserves. But they realize they're going to end up having to take care of them, because once you're off active duty, you're a veteran and you're in the VA system and you're out of the DOD system, which is Walter Reed, Brooks, Landstuhl, Bethesda Naval Hospital. So you're in the VA system. So I said, well, you know, they're bureaucrats there. They're trying to inflate the numbers. And the Pentagon, of course, is determined to show that this, you know, this war is not that risky. But when you look closely at the reasons are that the definition of a casualty in the VA is anybody evacuated from a combat area for any reason.
And in other words, you could be in a car accident.
Well, no, that's pretty interesting, because if you're in, I mean, let me just, you know, explain that. If you're in a Humvee and it gets hit by an RPG or a roadside bomb and bursts into flames and everybody in it is wounded, and the Humvee behind you runs into the first Humvee and there are injuries, it appears to me that the Pentagon lists those injuries as vehicular accidents, not as combat injuries.
I see. Now, there's one thing I wanted to know. We got off fairly easy in the first war, and by that I don't mean to show insult, but we only lost, what was it, 148 people? And some people said it looked more like a video game. Do you think that's why we're having trouble?
You mean Desert Storm 1, 1990?
Yeah, that's the one. And was it 148, something like that?
I think there were 148 wounded, to tell you the truth.
And I think there were that many killed or something like that. People said it looked more like a video game, and they thought every war was... there were some people who were worried that people would assume that every war was going to be like that.
Well, I mean, it appears to me that the people who got us into this war were the ones who thought it would be a video game. I mean, everybody with any sense knew that this was going to be difficult. I mean, General Shinseki, you know, tried to tell Wolfowitz and Rumsfeld and Pearl and Fife from his experience in Kosovo that you're going to need 300,000 troops to hold this together, and they ridiculed him.
Yeah, Melvin Laird, he wanted to depend on technology more than manpower, right?
Well, you know, the signature weapon in this war, as you know, is not the Tomahawk.
Not Melvin Laird, but Donald Rumsfeld.
Signature weapon in this war is not the Tomahawk missile and the GPS-guided laser bomb dropped from a F-16. It's the suicide bomber and the roadside bomb. And I address that in the Wounded, Vietnam to Iraq. I mean, General Whelan, you know, after the Vietnam War said, you know, that America relies on technology. And this only works if the enemy is not willing to take casualties. If they're willing to take casualties, then technology is problematical.
Well, it didn't work in Vietnam, and I guess it ain't working here either.
Well, I mean, I'm glad that you called. There are none of us, and I mean none of us, who were in Vietnam, wrote about Vietnam, who ever thought we would have to write anything like that again in our lifetime. I mean, none of us, whether it's Joe Galloway or Halberstram or Peter Arnett anybody, Tim O'Brien. None of us. I mean, we're baffled that we're sitting here writing again. I received an email from a reporter who was embedded in the hospital in Balad, who said that he had read 365 days while he was embedded. And he said as he was sitting out there in the desert reading the book, looking around and saying, my God, everything that he's written here is what we're seeing now. I mean, this is so... stupid.
Just to make sure that people understand, one of the big differences here between this war and Vietnam, there are a couple things that determine the kind of battlefield injuries that you see. One of them is the thing that you just mentioned, that what soldiers are dealing with is suicide bombers and roadside bombs. The other is that we now do have for soldiers very effective body armor, but it doesn't cover their whole body. It does a great job covering and protecting their torso, but not their legs and their arms. And so what we're seeing here is a lot of cases where people are having severe injuries to arms and legs, also and head injuries is a real big thing. And it has to do with, you know, this interaction between the kind of physical protection the soldier has and the threat that they face.
Well, I mean, one of the reasons that at least the official number is 2.4 casualties to death in Vietnam is that if you died, you were going to die right then and there. I mean, if you had your leg blown off in Vietnam, the chances were that you also had a penetrating chest wound or an abdominal injury and you bled to death. I mean, you were dead right there. You were dead before the medics got to you. The orthopedic surgeons and surgeons in Iraq, and I've talked to the dozens of them, which is the beginning of this war, were baffled. They would take these kids in off the choppers, and their legs would be gone. They'd have traumatic brain injuries, closed head injuries, penetrating head wounds. And they'd take off their body armor, and there wouldn't be a mark between their chin and their groin. Well, if you have your leg blown off or your arm blown off or a closed head injury, you're not going to die if you can stop the bleeding. And so you put on a tourniquet and you stop the bleeding. Even more importantly, I mean, there's a medication called Nova 7. It's an activated clotting factor 7. It's about $1,000 a milligram. And the medics now, I think, are beginning to carry it. But they certainly are using it in the surgical hospitals. So if you get your leg blown off, and the leg's blown off so high that you can't put a tourniquet on because your femoral artery is where it's torn, you can inject this medication, and those blood vessels that are torn clot off. In essence, what killed you in Vietnam is not killing you now. I mean, there's nobody that had both legs blown off and an arm outside of Max Cleland, who, you know, we took care of him, and he's our ex-senator from Georgia who had both his legs blown off and one arm following the Tet Offensive in 68. He survived with an enormous amount of work and luck. But most people, certainly almost everybody in Vietnam that lost a leg or an arm, died right there. And they're not dying there now. That's the reason that it's 16 to 1. But now we have multiple amputees. Now we have traumatic brain injuries from the shock waves. I mean, you know, when people talk about IEDs, I mean, it, you know, they sound innocuous. But let me just give you some of the physics of these IEDs. First of all, they are enormous. I mean, a lot of the IEDs, they wire together 200 or 355 millimeter shells. They put 100 pounds of Centex on top of it, maybe some canisters of butane. And when they set those off, I mean, they can turn over a 70-ton M1A1 tank. And the blast wave from the point of detonation, first of all, is 3,000 to 7,000 degrees Fahrenheit. The blast wave, the initial blast wave, is almost 400 tons of pressure per square inch, and it travels at 13,000 miles an hour. I mean, it is enormous. Anybody that's close to it is virtually dead. Further out, it's traumatic brain injuries, it's amputations. I mean, these are enormous weapons. And we have no strategy, by the way, against them. I talked to a surgeon that was at Balad who said the most difficult task was every Monday when they had to send a vehicle into Baghdad, and he had to pick somebody from the hospital staff to ride along. He said, I never knew if they were coming back. I mean, this is, the war is brutal. And for some reason, either the newspapers or the reporters haven't been able to explain it. It's still a little bit the video game stuff.
We have some other folks to talk with. Let's do that. And again, just very quickly, we're already past the midpoint. I want to introduce again our guest, Dr. Ronald Glasser. He's a physician. He works as a pediatrician in Minneapolis. He's also a writer. He spent a year as an Army doctor during the Vietnam War and wrote about that in his book, 365 Days. That was written in 1971. And as I said, a lot of people think that it's one of the best books to come out of Vietnam. Last summer, he published another book that deals with the issue here we've been talking about this morning, that is Battlefield Medicine Injuries Today and the Challenges and Problems Faced by Returning Soldiers Who Are Profoundly Injured and are so far shocking, coming up short in trying to help them. That book is Wounded, Vietnam to Iraq, and is out there now. Questions welcome. Let's go next and talk with someone in Urbana. This is Line 1. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I was hoping your guest could talk about the impact of the fact that this war has been fought so much more by reservists versus full-time soldiers as opposed to previous wars, and any kind of impact that might have on the care that they receive when they get back. And also, apart from the initial trying to get them so that they can at least function, if you could discuss the challenges that they face in trying to reenter the workforce, if they're able to do that, or confronting the fact that they're not going to be able to reenter the workforce, and what kind of financial support they get or don't get, depending on their reserve versus full-time status. And I will listen offline.
All right.
Well, I think the marvelous thing about a program like yours is that, this isn't the Today Show where they give you 3 minutes. Her questions are not questions anymore. They're realities. As far as the results of having a volunteer army and reserve units, the obvious result is that we don't have a country at war. We have a military at war. I mean, the vast majority of Americans are just uninvolved. I mean, it was jokingly said a year ago that if we had a draft, the war would end in 6 months because the vast majority of Americans would not want their sons and daughters going there. The use of reserve units is just another example of poor planning and not having enough troops. Nobody expected 40% of our troops over in Iraq and Afghanistan, and by the way, there have been 1.4 million that have rotated through, 40% to be reserve units or National Guard units. I mean, nobody. I know about the Minnesota National Guard. I mean, I know that people joined it to be able to go to Camp Ripley for 2 weeks in the summer and 2 Tuesdays a month to go to the armory and talk to their friends and help out in floods and natural catastrophes. They did not expect to spend a year in Iraq and then have their tour extended. We have 3,000 troops from Minnesota that are in Iraq, and they have had their tours extended by 4 months. And these are 35- and 40-year-olds. I mean, they're families. I mean, these are not, 21-year-old kids that shave their heads like Mohawk Indians. I mean, when Rumsfeld said that they knew what they were signing up for when they signed up for the National Guard, well, they didn't. They didn't expect this. It's just, again, the poor planning. I mean, it's General McCaffrey who said that the Army is going to be broken in another year. And there's another thing that your audience has to realize about the National Guard and reservists. When they come home from Iraq or Afghanistan and they get off the plane, they go home. I mean, they get off the plane, they get in their cars, and they go home. There is no reintegration program, none. At least if they were in a combat unit, they'd go back to a base, the physicians could watch them, their families could, they could talk about post-traumatic stress disorder, they could talk about the possible symptoms. In Minnesota, and I assume in every other state, they go home. We have a marvelous head of the National Guard here in Minnesota, General Shalito, who was in Vietnam. He's trying to put together an integration program, send people out to these troops' homes, talk to their wives, talk to their employers, tell them about what they can expect, about some hostility, about some anger. There's no money here. I mean, we have a Republican governor who hasn't released the money yet. I mean, there's no money for this program. And we know, everybody knows, that at least 20% of our troops in Afghanistan and Iraq, that's 20% of 1.4 million, at the minimum, will have post-traumatic stress disorder. That's based on Vietnam and the Second World War and the studies from the Israeli army. And nobody cares. I mean, it baffles the hell out of me.
Let me ask you, the issues here are so many and so complicated, and I'm sure that on other days and other ways with other guests, we'll try and get back to some of these things. But let me ask you about specifically about the other issue, one of the other issues that the caller raised, and that is the difficulties that people will face coming back from war, having these very profound injuries, in being able to work, and how many people with some sort of help and assistance would be able to go back to work, maybe not what they did before, but they would be able to work. And how many people do you think would be in the situation where they would be facing a permanent kind of disability and would not be able to work?
Well, we already know that. BLIMES, B-I-L-M-E-S, published a report about the costs of the war in Vietnam, in Iraq and Afghanistan, published by the John F. Kennedy School of Government, their report paper. Everybody has used that. I mean, it is really definitive, and the data there is straightforward. The Veterans Administration is divided up into the Veterans Disability Administration and the Veterans Healthcare Administration. The Disability Department is 400,000 claims behind. 400,000 claims behind. You put in a claim, and maybe in 21 months it'll be approved. Well, what are you going to do if you go back to Enid, Oklahoma? The costs for taking care of, if everybody left Iraq and Afghanistan by October 08, the costs are to take care of the wounded with is between $500 billion and $700 billion over the next 40 years. There's 155 Veterans Administration hospitals and clinics. Less than 100 have any capabilities for post-traumatic stress disorders. I mean the answer, you know, you say that things are complicated. Well, I don't think so. I mean, all of this can be handled by putting money into these programs, by taking care of these patients, but that money is not available. I mean, it's everybody knows what has to be done. Everybody at Walter Reed knew that Building 18 was falling apart, but the money for Walter Reed and the outpatient had been cut back. I mean, when Nicholson, who's the head of the VA, and of course Walter Reed is in the Pentagon system, but when he was going through his confirmation hearings, and he was, I think, the Republican national chairman for some southern state, I mean, during his confirmation hearing, he actually said that the VA has enough money, but like all government organizations, they simply have to learn how to use it better. Well, they're about $4 billion behind this year. Somebody has to give them the money. Somebody has to realize the price that this war is exacting, and nobody is, or nobody has, or nobody appears to be willing. I mean, this reintegration program in the state of Minnesota needs $6 million for the state. You know, where is it?
Let's go on and talk with some more folks here. Next, in the community of Belgium, not all that far away, in line number two. Hello.
Good morning, sir. I'd like to ask Mr. Glazer, you said you grew up in the military, sir?
No, no.
Oh, okay.
I mean, I was one of those, self-absorbed, smart, bright kids that went to Johns Hopkins Medical School. Uh-huh. I grew up in the Army when I realized that medicine was just another skill and that there were responsibilities that you had. We were all kind of pampered and adored.
Well, I misunderstood, sir, because I knew a Glazer when I was young in the military, and I was wondering if it might have been you. Thank you very much.
Okay.
I don't want to take a lot of time away from my main subject, but I guess going back to the beginning, I was a little bit curious about how a guy who was a pediatrician ended up treating battlefield injuries.
It's like that marvelous comment that Hawkeye makes in MASH, I was drafted.
They said, you're going, and that was that.
Well, yeah, we were deferred, you know. I mean, by following the Tet Offensive in 68, I mean, the Army was running out of everything. I mean, there had been 500,000 men there, and the selective service system, as you know, was sweeping up 20,000 enlistees or draftees a month for years on end, and they were running out of doctors, you know, and... a doctor is a doctor.
Yeah. Our guest is Ronald Glasser. He is a pediatrician. He practices medicine in Minneapolis. He served in the military and worked as an Army doctor during the Vietnam War. He wrote a book about that experience that was written in 1971. That book became a bestseller. That's 365 Days. His seventh book was published last summer, June of 2006, and that's a book that's dealing with the subject that we're talking about here this morning. The book is Wounded, Vietnam to Iraq.
And let me add this.
Yes, sir.
365 Days is still in print. I mean, it still sells 4,000 to 8,000 copies, 2,000 to 4,000 copies a year, and it's been translated into 19 languages, and they can get it on Amazon. But the importance of Wounded is that reporters are calling now and beginning to write about this and feel that people will be willing to listen and to do something. The problem is that the vast majority of Americans have not felt the responsibility or the pain or the suffering that this war brings. I mean, or has brought. You know, I dedicate Wounded to Joe Galloway, who was a reporter in Vietnam, and Hal Moore, who was the colonel that made the fight in the Idrang Valley that was turned into the movie We Were Soldiers Once and Young, where Mel Gibson plays General Moore, and to H.R. McMaster, who was the colonel of the 3rd Armored Cavalry that made the fight at Telfar. And, you know, I mean, nobody even knows about that battle that we were successful in. I just, when I visited the 3rd Armored Cavalry at Fort Carson, I think it was 2 years ago, a third of the troops were on food stamps. Food stamps. You know, everybody talks about Blackwater and the security people in Iraq. They're hiring first sergeants. What do they get? $600 a month, and they're giving them $150,000 a year. Hmm. I mean, we haven't taken care of any of these kids. Yeah. None.
Let's talk with another caller here. Let's go to Pontiac, line number 3. That's the next person in line. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
That's a very interesting discussion. I'd like you to say something about, Ken Burns was on last night on the radio talking about his new series coming out on World War II. And he mentioned how the whole country shared in that by cutting back, by having rationing, by participating, really deeply in that war, and what that meant as a country, how we pulled together. This war has had none of that. I feel that we've been absolutely prevented from feeling any of the immediate aspects of it unless we happen to have a family member over there. And I wonder if you could comment on that. I mean, I think that's a strategy to keep us from protesting against it. You know, if everyone was feeling that they couldn't drive, if they couldn't do things or whatever, as happened in World War II, with an unpopular war, it might change a lot faster. And also, the average person like me, I mean, I've done a lot of letter writing, I've done a little protesting, but we're not rising up because I think everybody's so confused about what the heck should happen now. I think everyone knows we shouldn't be there militarily. I know I'm running on about this, but I mean, it's really, but everyone's kind of paralyzed because it's like, we know we shouldn't just keep fighting. This isn't getting us anywhere, but what do we do? There's no plan that people can get behind. Just getting out isn't going to solve it either. We made this mess. So I just wondered if you could comment on that.
Well, I mean, I think we all share your anguish. There is no doubt that this administration has been very successful in downplaying the risks, the dangers, the problems, the casualties, the deaths, the types of wounds. I mean, they've been absolutely terrific at it, you know. I mean, and confusing. I mean, they're so determined that nobody's going to consider this to be Vietnam that they call it a surge instead of an escalation. I mean, they're not even using the words. And somebody mentions Vietnam, and one of their hacks comes out and says, no, this clearly isn't Vietnam. In Vietnam, we were fighting the North Vietnamese regular forces as well as an insurgency at the same time. Well, it is Vietnam. And until everybody tries to at least insist that their congressman give more money to the VA, that their congressman begins to make the fight, becomes a little tougher. You know, when I talked to Dana Priest and Ann Hall, who wrote the articles in the Washington Post, and I'll share this with you, I asked, why the Washington Post put those articles on the front page above the fold. And Dana Priest said, because of the election in November. And what she was saying is, with the Democrats coming into power, that there would be hearings, that this no, that they wouldn't be able to bury this. You know, I had given a number of talks on NPR, and during those talks, when people asked, you know, what is a pediatrician in Minneapolis doing writing about this? Why don't we hear about it from somewhere else? I had said that it's because we don't have reporters anymore, we have stenographers. I got an angry phone call from a reporter who said, look, it's not our fault. He said, if there is a murder in Minneapolis, and we write that there's a murder, the second story is about the police investigation. The third story is about the charging of the possible suspects. The next story is about the trial. The next story is about the verdict. He said there has been no investigation. We wrote about Abu Ghraib, and where was the congressional investigation? You know, we wrote about there were no weapons of mass destruction. Where was the investigation? You know, we've written about the lack of body armor, the lack of upgrading the Humvees. You know, where was the investigation? We can't write the same story all the time. Well, we're on our way now. I mean, the Democrats are finally having hearings. This administration, with the Republican Senate and Congress, has blocked all of that. Well, we're on our way. And I think that people, it's the reason that, well, when the Washington Post article came out and I got the 200 or 300 emails, there was no angry comments there, none. I mean, and yet after the Harper's article in July 05, you know, it was, why don't you talk about the good things, you know, how many hospitals we're building and repainting. Well, you know, by that time I had talked to enough people that said that the problem wasn't rebuilding schools and painting hospitals. The problem was getting there alive and getting back.
I want to try and get at least one more caller here. Let's go to talk with someone in Kankakee. This is line four. Hello.
With all due consideration for the position of the guest, this caller would suggest that in spite of the unfortunate fiasco of the president's private military adventures and the resulting horrendous American casualties, the casualties to the citizens of the states invaded, and more importantly, the catastrophic impacts of these adventures on American foreign relations represent the most major effects of this whole mess. After all, our killed and wounded are the result of our acquiescences and the acquiescences of our Congress. This is what we're doing to ourselves, but what we are doing to others and the prices we will eventually pay for that are even worse. Will the guest please comment?
Thank well, you. I think that you're right. I mean, the Johns Hopkins School of Public Health in October 04 had done a survey of the number of casualties and deaths in Iraqi civilians. And they came up with it. This was 04. They came up with 100,000, but that was published right before the election, and it was buried. I mean, it's hundreds of thousands. The answer to your question is the answer that Joe Galloway, this marvelous writer for Knight Ridder, said when I was writing Wounded. I said, you know, Joe, how would you explain all of this? And he said, it's simple, that these people who sent us into Iraq have those three qualities virtually guaranteed to cause a disaster: incompetent, arrogant, and in charge. And that's them.
We'll do one more. We'll go to Champagne. Hello.
Yes, actually part of my question was answered there. That's something that I've been curious about for a long time, that the burying of the Johns Hopkins study and the fact that, you know, if you look at the UN numbers of people who are killed in Iraq, it's easily 3 to 5 times what you read in any newspaper in the States.
Probably 6 times.
Okay.
Yeah, and, but, no, I mean, what you said is absolutely correct. I mean, that was an analysis that every statistician said was accurate. I mean, they sent Iraqi, it's when you could move around Iraq, they sent interviewers to the homes, and it was absolutely buried by the press. What the press said before the election was, boy, these numbers are really screwy. They're not the numbers we're getting. And they refused to run it.
Yeah, it's the only professionally done, actually, analysis that I'm aware of. I mean, actually, according to the standards. And by the way, I did hear that Bush wants to cut the VA again. Is that, am I correct in that?
Well, they've already cut the research for traumatic brain injuries, Pentagon, because they said that they haven't, they didn't have enough money. They cut it in half this year. I mean, this is, I mean, it's baffling, you know. And I, and the woman who called before you, or the woman who called two call-ins before you, saying, "What can we do?" Well, all you have to do is call your congressman. You know, this is, we can't do it ourselves. You know, Lincoln made that marvelous comment about government. The function of government is to do for people what they can't do for themselves. Well, it's time to lean on our government.
We're going to have to stop. I'm really sorry that we have come to the end of the time, because I think we've just scratched the surface on the subject, and I'm sure that there are a lot of other ways. We'll try in future shows, I'm sure, to be talking about this again. But right for the moment, we're going to have to stop. And certainly, if you're interested in reading on the subject, you can look for the book that we mentioned here a couple times that our guest, Dr. Ronald Glasser, has written, the book Wounded, Vietnam to Iraq. That was published last summer, and I'm sure that you can find it in the bookstore. You might also want to look for that book that he wrote back in 1971, also about his experiences as an Army doctor during the Vietnam War. The book is 365 days, and as he said, the book is still in print, and there are a lot of people who think that it's one of the best books about U.S. involvement in Vietnam, so you can look for that. Our guest, Dr. Ronald Glasser, is a pediatrician. He practices in Minneapolis. And Dr. Glasser, thanks very much.
Well, listen, this was a treat, and may I say that this was much more comforting and more fun and enjoyable than the Today Show.
Well, thanks. Thanks for that vote of confidence. We appreciate it.